You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiyah. The prodigious author and journalist Jonah Lehrer has come out with his second book, titled How We Decide. He spoke at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight. It's a special honor and pleasure to be talking at my favorite local bookstore. So really, thank you so much for coming tonight and listening to me and indulging me as I try to talk through this book tour cold. I'd like to begin by telling you how I came to write a book on decision-making, how I went from writing a book on Proust and Gertrude Stein to a book about Cheerios and Texas Hold'em. And I got the idea in the supermarket. My wife and I had recently returned from living overseas, and we're still adjusting to the surreal abundance of the American supermarket. The fact that you've got 200 different types of toothpaste, 100 different types of floss, you know, just thread, and yet there are 100 different types of it. And we'd gotten all our things together, all our food, and we put them on the conveyor belt. We're checking out when we remember that we'd forgotten to buy breakfast cereal. So I'm sent back to the cereal aisle. I run back with relatively straightforward instructions, which is to buy a box of Cheerios. And I get there and I locate the big box of yellow original Cheerios. And no sooner do I reach for the Cheerios and I think to myself, you know, that box of Honey Nut Cheerios right next to that, I should get that. Honey Nut Cheerios are much more delicious than regular Cheerios. So I reach for the box of Honey Nut Cheerios, only to see right next to that a box of multigrain Cheerios. And I think, you know, I should get more fiber in my diet. I should buy the multigrain. But the multigrain is $3.99, and I see right next to that the generic Cheerios are $2.99. So I reach for the box of generic Cheerios. I'll spare you the entire interior monologue, but 10 minutes go by and I spot my wife out of the corner of my eye looking at me like I've lost my mind, because I can't pick a box of Cheerios. So it was that everyday failure that first got me interested in the subject. I wanted to know, number one, what was happening inside my mind as I failed to buy a box of Cheerios, and number two, and more importantly, what should have been happening inside my mind as I tried to make a decision about breakfast cereal. And that got me interested in this topic. And for a long time, ever since the ancient Greeks, people have thought they understood decision-making. It seemed like a relatively straightforward thing. Human decision-making was about humans being rational. What separated humans from every other animal, what elevated us above these lower creatures, was the fact that we're capable of being rational and deliberate, applying logic to our breakfast options or to our toothpaste options. Plato famously compared the human mind to a chariot, and there was this rational rider, this rational charioteer, whose job was to keep a tight rein on these emotional horses. And the job of the rational rider was to make sure the emotions didn't run wild, that these horses didn't run wild, and to focus and keep a tight rein on them and exercise reason. That's what defined good decision making. That's what made a philosopher king possible, the fact that humans could be rational. It's an elegant theory. It's a great metaphor. Freud recapitulated the exact same metaphor, you know, 1900 years later. But this theory of humans being rational agents turns out to be almost entirely wrong. And I think some of the most compelling evidence for this comes from case studies of the neurologist Antonio Damasio, who's now at USC. And in the early 80s, he began studying patients who, often because of a brain tumor in the frontal lobes, lost the ability to experience emotion. So these subtle signals of pleasure and fear and anxiety that we all take for granted, these people couldn't experience. And if you were Plato, you would assume that these people would be uber rational. They'd be perfectly rational agents. They would make the best decisions. They should be the philosopher kings. But instead, what you find is that this defect, not being able to experience emotion, is actually debilitating. And that these people became pathologically indecisive. They were an extreme version of me in the cereal aisle. They would spend 5 hours trying to figure out where to eat lunch. They would spend all day trying to choose between a blue pen or a black pen or a red pen. These very everyday decisions became all but impossible. So this got me thinking in the sense that pure reason isn't a gift. It's not something to aspire to. Pure reason turns out to be a disease. And this really, I think, drew me to the subject. Here was this chance, I think, that scientists are breaking open the black box, actually looking inside these 3 funny pounds of gelatinous flesh and revealing interesting things about how we make these everyday decisions. And in a sense, neuroscience was becoming a practical science. So that drew me to the subject. But I'd like to start talking tonight by telling you a story. And this is one of those stories that as a writer, as soon as you read the story, as soon as you hear about it, you want to tell it. You have no idea what you want to say about it. You have no idea it's going to fit into an article or a book, but you know you want it in there somewhere. And my wonderful editor is here tonight, and she can tell you've been trying to work this story into this book for a long time. And the story goes like this. It's the second day of the ground invasion of the First Persian Gulf War. Pre-dawn hours, 5:01 in the morning, Michael Riley, Lieutenant Commander Michael Riley, and the HMS Gloucester's in the radar room. His job is to protect the Allied convoy behind him. The convoy consists of 20-plus ships, American battleships, destroyers, and two aircraft carriers. And his job is to watch the radar screen and make sure no silkworm missiles get past his defenses. Silkworm missiles are a massive Chinese-made missiles that the Iraqis had stockpiled. Each missile was so big it was capable of sinking an American battleship all by itself. So his job is to watch the radar screen, make sure there are no silkworms launched that day from the Iraqi bases on the Persian Gulf. The convoy had to come in close, well within range of the silkworm missiles, because they were shelling in support of the Marines invading Kuwait. So it's 5:01 in the morning. Michael Riley sees two blips, two neon green blips on his radar screen, and they appear right off the Iraqi coast near the Kuwaiti border. And the funny thing about these blips is that as soon as Michael Riley sees them, he experiences this terrifying emotion, this strong feeling of fear. He's convinced, as soon as he sees these blips, that they're silkworm missiles and that they need to be shot down. So as soon as he sees them, within seconds, he gives the order to prepare to launch sea darts. These are the sea-to-air missiles that the British used to shoot down silkworm missiles. So it's 5:02. He just sees these neon blips and he gives the order to prepare to launch. But here's his problem. These two neon green radar blips are traveling along the exact same route that he's watched American A-6 fighter jets fly for the last 4.5 weeks. They take off from the aircraft carriers behind him, drop their bombs in Iraq, and then return just off the Iraqi coast in the exact same place where these blips are as they return to the aircraft carriers. So they're traveling along the exact same spatial route that A-6 fighter jets have been traveling. These two blips, Michael Riley rationally knows, could just as easily be American aircraft. That he knows he can't rationally distinguish between A-6 aircraft and what he's convinced are silkworm missiles, what his emotions are convinced are silkworm missiles. He's got 45 seconds to make a decision. These blips are traveling just over Mach 1, which is the same speed that silkworm missiles and A-6 fighter jets travel. So what does he do? I mean, imagine how agonizing this is. If he does nothing, if he doesn't shoot down these blips and they are silkworm missiles, then the USS Missouri is about to be sunk. These two silkworms, which are heading straight for that, will sink this ship. Hundreds of sailors will die. It'll be the most catastrophic episode for the Allies during the entire Persian Gulf War. However, if he launches the sea darts, shoots down these blips, and they turn out to be A-6 fighter jets, then four American pilots are about to die. He's going to be court-martialed. His career will be over. He's going to have to tell his commanding officer that he killed four American pilots because he got scared. You know, because one morning at 5:01, he experienced this funny emotion, and that's why he launched his missiles. It's not a very good excuse. One interesting side note, which I've just learned, one of the pleasures of writing a book is then gets read, and people help annotate your stories. And it turned out, and I didn't know this from talking to Michael Riley at the time, was that there were much more advanced radar systems watching the coast that day. There was an AWACS aircraft above. In fact, there were U.S. ships who were trying to perform the same mission, who were trying to watch out for these silkworm missiles as well. But they didn't even see these blips. These blips didn't even activate their alert. And the reason is that these radar systems were largely automated. And so they saw these blips, which were traveling in the exact same pattern of A-6 fighter jets. And so the automated radar systems, the much more advanced radar systems, no alarms went off. They never even thought, it never even occurred to these computers that these might be silkworm missiles. They assumed, because of their spatial pattern, that they were simply A-6 fighter jets returning to the aircraft carriers. So what does Michael Riley do? He ends up, after 45 seconds, 45 agonizing seconds, he gives the order to fire. He watches as these blips race towards each other. He watches as these two neon green blips, whatever they are, they fall out of the sky 700 meters in front of the USS Missouri. So whatever it was he shot down, it was that close to potentially sinking the USS Missouri. Needless to say, the next few hours are the most agonizing hours of Michael Riley's life. His commander comes after, gives the order to fire, and says, "What did you launch at? How did you know those were silkworm missiles?" And Michael Riley says, I just knew. He then goes, he's then ordered to go back to the tapes to see if he can prove that these were Silkworm missiles, that there was some defining signal, and he can't find anything. He realizes in those hours that he could have just as easily literally shot down an A6 fighter jet. A few hours go by, teams are sent out to scour the wreckage, and it turns out that Mike O'Reilly shot down Silkworm missiles, that he was a hero, that he saved the day, he saved this American battleship from being sunk. That was the way the matter rested. The British Navy then, after the war, went back and reviewed the tapes from that morning. And based on their investigation, based on their comparisons of these blips, their analysis of what Mike O'Reilly saw on his radar screen that morning, they concluded that Mike O'Reilly got lucky. That there was no way to rationally distinguish between the A6 blips, the blips of the A6, and the blips of the Silkworm missile. That he was a hero, but he was just a lucky hero. The case was closed. That's the way the matter rested until Gary Klein, a cognitive psychologist, who's probably best known for studying the intuition of firefighters, but also a consultant to the Marine Corps, got interested in the story of Mike O'Reilly. And he went back to the tapes, to the radar tapes, and to the blips. Only he didn't just look at the blips from that morning. He went back and looked at the pattern of blips that Mike O'Reilly got him used to seeing for the previous month and a half as he'd followed these A6 fighter jets and F-18 Hornets as they take off from the aircraft carriers, drop their bombs, and come back. And what he found was that there was a subtle discrepancy, that actually was a way to distinguish between the blips of the Silkworm that Mike O'Reilly saw that morning and the blips of the A6 fighter jets. And the discrepancy was this, that because A6 planes at that point in their mission tend to fly between 3 and 10,000 feet, they go wet feet, which is the technical term for becoming visible on the naval radar. They go wet feet as soon as they hit the water. So within a single sweep of the naval radar, and we've all seen those Tom Clancy movies, we all know, you know, the thing sweeps around. Within one sweep of the radar, they became visible. So as soon as they hit the Persian Gulf. The Silkworm missiles that morning, because they traveled at 1,000 feet, there was a bit more ground interference. So they didn't become visible until about 3.5 seconds later, until the third sweep of the radar. So even though they were traveling along the exact same spatial route, even though they look like they could just as easily be A6 fighter jets, there was a subtle timing discrepancy. And it was the timing discrepancy that, according to Gary Klein, generated this powerful instinctive fear that led Mike O'Reilly to give the order to fire. He knew, even though he couldn't explain why, that these blips needed to be shot down. Now, I love this story for all the obvious reasons. It's suspenseful. It sounds like it could be straight from a Tom Clancy novel. And in the book, I use it to illustrate something about the dopamine system, how the dopamine system works. And the dopamine system has for a long time been kind of denigrated as the neurotransmitter of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was the chemical that led us to eat too much chocolate cake and, you know, do all sorts of irresponsible stuff. And dopamine is guilty of all that stuff. It does lead us to indulge in sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But in the last few years, scientists have also discovered that dopamine is a crucial component of cognition, that it's also an essential ingredient of learning that allows us to translate the helter-skelter of reality into patterns, to make sense of these patterns, to make predictions, then make sure our predictions are accurate. And I think some of the seminal work in dopamine has been done by a Cambridge neuroscientist named Wolfram Schultz, who his experiments observe a fairly straightforward protocol. He began studying dopamine because of Parkinson's patients, but he quickly got interested in dopamine as kind of the measure of reward. And so he would give monkeys squirts of juice and record from individual dopamine neurons in the midbrain of the monkey. And what he found is that, sure enough, if you give a monkey a squirt of apple juice, that's the pleasurable reward, these dopamine neurons will fire. They'll respond to the apple juice and the monkey will get this feeling of pleasure, this feeling of, delicious apple juice. So far, so straightforward. Dopamine's the hedonic meter in the brain. It measures pleasure. That's what everyone assumed. But then Schultz discovered that if you keep on giving monkeys these squirts of juice, before long, their dopamine neurons stop firing. They get bored by the reward. And so this kind of confused him. And then one day, he's opening the door to his lab. Just opening the door, and he hears this distinctive snap, crackle, pop of a firing dopamine neuron. And this kind of is even more confusing to him. Why would these neurons be firing when he opens the door? And then he begins to think about it, and he realizes, well, maybe these neurons know that every time he opens the door, apple juice is on its way, that soon they'll be getting a squirt of apple juice. Maybe they're predicting the reward. So then he sets up this elegant series of experiments where, and these were very much modeled on Pavlov and classical conditioning. You ring a bell and give a squirt of juice. And what you find is that before long, after only a few trials, these dopamine neurons will fire when you ring a bell. And if you flash a light before ringing a bell, they'll fire when you flash a light. And if you play a song before flashing a light, before ringing a bell, before giving the monkey a squirt of juice, they'll fire when you play the song. In other words, the reward itself isn't that interesting to them. What they want to find is the first event that predicts the reward. He calls these cells prediction neurons because that's what they do. Their job is to predict rewards, to find the pattern and locate the first part of that pattern that predicts reward. Now you can quickly see how useful this setup might be. You know, the monkey that can predict the reward of bananas or apple juice or whatever it is monkeys eat farthest in advance will get the most of it. They'll get the most bananas. So you can imagine how useful this is. It lets you find those kind of, you know, subtle patterns in the real world and then to act upon them, to make predictions about what will happen and then double check to make sure your predictions are right. Now the question becomes, how do these cells, this relatively discrete circuit of cells in the brain, how do they get so accurate at predicting, at finding these patterns? How do they actually know that the light precedes the bell, which precedes the juice? And this is where something called the prediction error signal comes in handy. So let's say one day you're in a bad mood and you decide to, you know, you've trained the monkey to play a song, flash a light, ring a bell, squirt of juice. So this time you play a song, flash a light, ring a bell, no juice. You don't give the monkey the reward it's been trained to expect. What happens then? This is where you see the dopamine neurons emit. It's called a prediction error signal. This is their way of telling the brain something's gone wrong, we've made a mistake, there's an error. The prediction we assume is going to happen, the reward we expected didn't arrive. And I asked a scientist once, you know, what does this feel like? And the funny story he told me was, let's say you've had a rough morning, you've worked all morning, you didn't have time for lunch, you had to work through lunch, now it's 2 in the afternoon, all you want is a Snickers bar from the vending machine. You know, that's, you've been thinking about that for the last 4 hours. So you walk to the vending machine, you get your 4 quarters, you put in 1 quarter, 2 quarters, 3 quarters, 4 quarters, you type in C-O-5, the code. You watch the Snickers bar slowly come forward on the robotic arm, then right before it drops down to the place you can reach it, it gets stuck. And it's that feeling of frustration, that just, you know, childish anger that leads you to punch the machine, shake the machine. That's what a prediction error feels like. You expected that Snickers bar and it didn't arrive. So now you can begin to understand how this signal becomes such a crucial component. It's the signal to your brain that it's got to rewire its predictions. It's got to make a whole new set of predictions, that what it expected didn't happen and maybe it should rejigger what it expects. This turns out, in recent years, it's become a crucial component of machine learning. So it's been used to program everything from banks of elevators to cell phone towers. The best backgammon player in the world now is actually just a simple software program that learned how to play backgammon using this prediction error learning. It's called temporal difference learning in the computer science world. But it's a exact same basic mechanism, this computational mechanism invented by natural selection tens of millions of years ago, if not hundreds of millions of years ago, turns out to be an unbelievably efficient way to learn. It's the reason your brain is able to make sense of reality and it costs as much electricity as that of a 20-watt light bulb. It's why you perceive in such efficient ways in large part. So now I think we can go back to Michael Riley and begin to make sense of what happened in his brain that morning. So it's 5:01 in the morning and some dopamine neuron somewhere in his midbrain sees a part of the pattern it didn't expect. Here's this blip, it's traveling along the same spatial route, but its timing is just off by 3.5 seconds. It releases a prediction error signal, which is passed from synapse to synapse. It eventually reaches a part of the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex, which scientists often refer to, and I should double check and make sure no little kids are here. They call it the oh shit circuit, because it's kind of activated when people are surprised in unexpected ways, when we have to deal with contradictions and stuff like that. This then generates this intense emotion of fear, given the context of that morning, of the fact that he's looking for radar blips, and that's when he gives the order to fire. It's this emotion that is generated by perhaps a few neurons that see a pattern they don't expect. Now one thing I like about this and all this dopaminergic work is the fact that it kind of recasts how we think of our emotions. And I think many of us, like Plato, see our emotions as these impulsive, impetuous things, as things we should ignore that lead us to just have too much sex, do too many drugs, and listen to too much rock and roll. But it turns out when you look at them in the brain that our emotions can also reflect this astonishing amount of computation, of analysis. It's just analysis of stuff we have no conscious awareness of. Michael Riley didn't know about the pattern of the blips. Nevertheless, his neurons did. They knew stuff and they were able to act on information that was just below the surface, the lid of consciousness, that was in that locked door. And in this sense, his emotions were deeply empirical. They were acting on facts, on subtle differences in patterns that even though he couldn't perceive, his emotions allowed them to make decisions based on them. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that we should always just trust sweaty palms and racing heart, you know, racing pulses and our emotions. That would be a terrible, terrible piece of advice. We shouldn't always blink or trust our gut. One of the things that I like the most about this science of decision making is how you can see how the exact same system, which can be so wise in some cases, in some circumstances, which can allow Michael Riley to make this prophetic decision, can also be profoundly idiotic. Can also lead us to do things that are insane, that ruin our life. And I illustrated this in the book with the story of Anne Clanestever, who she was a high school English teacher in West Virginia when she was diagnosed with Parkinson's at the age of 55. Parkinson's is caused by the massive cell death of dopamine neurons in the back of your brain, the brain area that controls bodily movement. And she experienced all the traditional symptoms, the jitters and the temporary bouts of paralysis. And her doctor put on what's a fairly standard treatment, which involves a dopamine agonist. These are drugs that mimic the activity of dopamine in the brain. And at first, for Anne, this drug, this dopamine agonist, was like a miracle cure. It virtually erased her symptoms. She could go back to work. She described it as, all her symptoms disappeared. She'd forget for hours at a time that she was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But the problem with dopamine agonists, the treatment, is that over time you have to be put on higher and higher doses because your cells continue to die, and so you have to take higher and higher doses of the drug to compensate. And that's when Anne discovered one of the debilitating side effects of these drugs. And this is, according to some studies, it afflicts as many as 10% of patients with Parkinson's on these drugs, and the side effect is slot machine addiction. Anne became a gambling addict, and in her case, her addiction ruined her life. She lost all her life savings, $250,000. Her husband left her. She stole coins from her grandkids. She described a typical day to me like this. She woke up at 5 in the morning and go to the local racino, the dog racing track that had slots. She'd play there till midnight when the racino closed. Then she would go to the local convenience store. In West Virginia, the convenience stores can have slots, and she'd play there till 3 in the morning when the convenience store closed, which point she'd go back home and play slots on her computer. Not for money, just for fun. Then she'd go back to the racino at 5. She could keep this up for, 2 to 3 days at a time. She sold everything she could sell, sold her car, her wedding ring, her jewelry. She was living, as she put it to me, on peanut butter straight from the jar. I think one of the saddest parts to me of her story is that it never occurred to her that this addiction might be just a side effect, that her Parkinson's medication might actually be causing the slot machine addiction, or at least in any way related to it. So she simply discovered her mortal flaw, the sin she couldn't resist. And it wasn't until 2006 when her neurologist took her off her medication that the compulsion disappeared, and disappeared almost right away, within the week. And she hasn't gambled since. And the question becomes, why would it have this side effect in to 10% of patients? And this gets back to, I think, the flip side of the prediction error signal, which is the fact that surprising rewards, those rewards we don't expect, those generate the largest spike, the largest surge of dopamine. They make us the happiest. The best tasting juice is the most surprising juice. So Schultz shows this. He'll train monkeys, play a song, flash a light, ring a bell, squirt of juice. But then sometimes he'll just give a squirt of juice for no particular reason, not preceded by any event. What you find is this generates a signal that's, as he puts it, 3 to 4 times larger than a predictable reward. This is the best juice. It makes you the most excited. Now, in the case of a slot machine, you can see how games of chance prey on the system. What is a slot machine but this continuous payout of surprising rewards? It's a random number generator. So your dopamine neurons, the reason you get this large surge is your brain wants you to pay attention to the surprising reward, to figure it out, to see if there's some logic there that will allow you to understand it and thus make sense of it and thus get more bananas or squirts of apple juice. But in a slot machine, there is no pattern to find. The secret is there is no secret. It's just a random number generator spitting out quarters occasionally. Over the long term, of course, you're being bled dry, you're losing lots of money. But in the short term, you get these occasional payouts, these surprising rewards. And when you're on a dopamine agonist, your brain is sloshing full of this synthetic neurotransmitter in a way. And so these surprising rewards generate this massive payout. And so your brain is convinced there's something really important here to find. You've got to pay attention. And so you're riveted by what's essentially a random number generator stealing your money. And I think that's the tragic irony in terms of games of chance. I was just in Vegas last month, and having written about dopamine, you can't help but smell dopamine when you walk into a casino. it's a scent of those surprising rewards. And this isn't a new idea. Pavlov, 100 years ago, found that when you gave a monkey when you give a dog, when in essence are surprising rewards, you know, the unconditioned thing that you just occasionally give it food without ringing a bell, without having a drool first, those connections, that stimulus response connection, when it was reinforced by randomness, those were the only connections you couldn't extinguish. That they were so strong because of this dopamine surge that all the, you know, after the fact training in the world couldn't extinguish them. So I think what that illustrates is how the exact same mechanism, this is really just the flip side of the prediction error signal, let's just say positive prediction error, can lead us to act in insane ways, can ruin our life. How the exact same mechanism, put in a different context, can have tragic results. It's not prophetic or wise or intuitive at all. It's beyond stupid. You wish you could just walk out of the casino, override this computational signal that's telling you to ruin your life. So now the question becomes, what do we do with this knowledge? I think it's fascinating stuff. We're learning how our brain cells compute rewards, make predictions, decipher patterns. What do we do with it? And this is where something called metacognition comes in handy. And metacognition is a word I love because it sounds really complicated, but it's actually really simple. It's thinking about thinking. And probably the classic example of metacognition is tip of the tongue. When it works on the tip of your tongue, when you run into someone on the street and you know their name, you know you went to high school with them, they're one of your Facebook friends, but you can't produce their name. It's on the tip of your tongue. And this always fascinated me, you know. How does the mind know what it doesn't know? How do you know you've got the memory in there somewhere if you can't produce it? And this is because we're naturally metacognitive. We're always thinking about how we think. We've always got this extra mechanism keeping track of all our ideas and thoughts and emotions and memories, and it knows it's in there somewhere even though we can't produce it. And in the case of decision making, what makes metacognition so handy is it allows you to adjust your decision making process, your thought process, to the task at hand. So depending on what you're thinking about, if you're in a radar room and you're a trained, experienced radar expert, if you're a lieutenant commander in the British Navy, then you should think a certain way. You might want to trust your sweaty hand. However, if you're in a casino, you should probably not listen to your dopamine neurons. You know, it allows you to toggle back and forth to think about what kind of decision am I making, how much information does it have, how many variables are there, how should I be thinking about that problem? And then because we've been blessed with metacognition, because it's this profoundly human capability, we can actually tailor our thought process to that decision. And this is, I think, what makes me most excited about the field, in the sense that learning about how we think, learning about how these 3 pounds of flesh actually work, can help us make better decisions, can help us think better. Thank you, everyone, so much. It was such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the journalist and author, Jonah Lehrer, on ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.